Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June the 12th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Ingrid Christiansen. Her subject, using place and symbol in our stories. Let's listen in.
My name is Ingrid Christiansen, and the title of this session is... I never know what my title is. It's about place and symbol. It's a Barbara Kingsolver short story, in any case. And I'm afraid I have to confess that I've done a bait and switch with you all. I was going to read Survival Zone, and I studied it, and I just couldn't get to the bottom of it, and so I switched to Extinctions, which I found was much easier to get to the bottom of and more fun. Extinctions is a story about, it's Easter, it's an Easter story. Survival Zones was Thanksgiving, and this one is Easter. And it is about, among other things, extinctions. I mean, there's a lot of concern about endangered species and, you know, a continuation of human life. And doing that, of course, at Easter time is a nice kind of a conjunction. Certain words that I think might be helpful to kind of keep your ears tuned to. Well, a concept, family life. Refusal to participate in family life, wanting to participate, what is family, how do you participate appropriately, when do people withdraw from family life and why? And then truth. There's lots of discussion about truth. The word truth is used quite a lot. The role of truth, the need for truth, the sort of relative healthiness or dysfunction of truth. There's some places where there are at least two places where the protagonist elects not to tell the truth, and we have to think about why she does that, and in probably relationship to the questions about family life. It being an Easter story, inevitably there are some things about religion in it. There are things about the role of religion in our lives, the misuse of religion and the use of religion. There's a fair amount of abuse of power in this story. And so religion is one of the lenses that abuse of power is looked at through. And I think a family is another way that you question power and you think about power in the story. And then all the things that they mentioned that could become extinct. Among them are a way of life. And then there are pandas and whales and tigers and mountain gorillas and bamboo and several other animals. Certain habits, and family. So I think with those comments, I guess the last question I'd like to ask you to think about is, do you think that it preaches? Does this story preach to us or not? And if so, are we grateful or do we wish it wouldn't? It's in this book, Homeland and Other Stories. I have the old edition of it, so the copies in the bookstore don't look like this one, but they do have copies of this book in the bookstore, and I highly recommend it. It's a wonderful, wonderful book of short stories. So I think the copies in the bookstore have a maybe blue and green cover. But it's Barbara Kingsolver's Homeland, and this story is Extinctions. It may already be too late for the pandas, the man on TV says. When Westerners first discovered them, they were so fascinated they just couldn't kill enough. Now there are only a few pandas left, and the best efforts of science can't seem to bring them back. Paired up in zoos, They turn their backs on one another and refuse to participate in family life. It's as if the whole species is suffering from a terrible sadness, as though they'd looked around at what had happened and just given up. Grace doesn't blame them. She sits rigidly in bed next to her husband, arms folded tightly over her chest. The program shows an old film clip of men emerging in high leather boots from the bamboo forest, holding up panda skins stretched on wooden frames. The image gives her chills. It is so full of evil. It's like seeing a child's toy flayed. They shouldn't tell people it's already too late, Randall says. If people think that, they won't care anymore. But it's the truth, says Grace. That's how things are with the ocean and the ozone and everything. Once they get around to looking, they find out that things are already way more messed up than anybody thought. That's not true. There's somebody someplace that knows when things start to get poisoned, but they try to keep it a secret. They know people would get mad. It's never too late to get mad, he persists, looking at Grace, needing for her to agree that there is hope. There has always been this difference between them, a deep gulf. She can't swim. I wish Jacob could see this, she says. The boys are in bed. Endangered species are Jacob's hobby. His room swims with posters of every possible kind of whale. When Grace stands in the middle of them, picking up socks in a great fishbowl, she can fathom the depth of the ocean's despair. Jacob knows all the numbers, how many tigers are left, how many mountain gorillas. This is the last thing in the world Jacob needs to watch, Randall says. He thinks Jacob carries it too far. Grace wants the program to stop, but feels it would be wrong to turn it off. It would be turning away from truth. A Chinese woman scientist measures bamboo shoots on a tiny plot of ground. It takes acres of bamboo to keep a panda alive, she explains, and most of it has been cut down to make way for rice paddies. Over Grace's head, rain strikes the roof like bullets and makes her tired. Tomorrow, she and the boys have to drive 100 miles to have dinner and go to church with her relatives. It's Easter weekend, only once a year. She shouldn't resent it. Randall thinks Grace is afraid of her family, which of course is a mistaken opinion, but she does dread the trip. A storm has settled over all of central Kentucky, and she knows the drive will be hard. Every so often, the scientist says, all the bamboo in a whole mountain range will die back to the roots, and there is massive starvation. In the old days, the pandas could go somewhere else, but now there is no place for them to go. A film clip shows emaciated panda bodies like sad beanbag chairs littering the forest floor. Grace presses her knees together and holds her elbows to resist the urge to get up again and see if the boys are still breathing. 10 years ago, when they were babies, she argued with Randall that crib death was real, that something really could happen. Now she knows it isn't rational to need to see, 6 times every night, the slight movement of their chests under the covers. Randall calls her a worrier. Now, with so much on TV about addiction, he's decided that's her problem. He has said he thinks Grace is addicted to sadness. The early weather report said the storm was expected to continue through the weekend. There isn't much rain right now, though, only a fine mist that occasionally freezes on the windshield. The road could be slick, but it's impossible to know that until you try to stop. Red taillights waver and leap in the dimness ahead of her like sparks escaped from a fireplace. What did you bring for church? She asks the boys. Randall says they're old enough to do things for themselves, to pack their own clothes, for example. She does try. Our good shirts and jeans, Matt says. She smiles at the tops of their 2 brush-cut heads in the mirror. Good shirts means bright colors, turquoise, fuchsia. Matt has a pair of green sneakers with red tongues. She imagines her 2 sons flowering on the church pew among all the brown-suited farm boys, like butterfly weeds in a bean patch. Her grandmother would die if they skipped church, but she would do worse than that, die if she saw that. They'll have to borrow jackets from Rita's kids. The boys are good on trips. They can both read in the car without getting sick. Jacob has a new National Geographic book on the condors. Matthew, who is a year younger, is making an elaborate crayon drawing of a brontosaurus, which now the scientists are calling something different. Grace forgets what. Matt knows all the names. His infatuation is not whales, but dinosaurs, species that are already gone. It strikes her that by the time her sons are grown, there will be little difference. Their own children will view whales as kinds of dinosaurs, mythical beasts, not something real to mourn. They will never believe those huge, fish-like creatures moved through the seas in modern times, while people were driving around in Hondas and drawing money from bank machines. They arrive late. Rita, Grace's cousin, has been keeping dinner warm in the oven for 2 hours. Grace hadn't even worried about the time. She'd forgotten the country habit of eating the main meal in the middle of the day. She hurries the boys to the table while the men bring extra chairs from the kitchen. Grace sees how much she's forgotten. These meals of baked ham with pineapple and marshmallows and slices of Wonder Bread passed around on a plate. Her grandmother, Naomi, accuses Grace of putting on airs since she moved away from Clement. But Grace has never tried to put the past behind her. Large parts of her childhood just seem to erase themselves quietly while she's not looking. Naomi and Rita will mention important family illnesses, even vacations they took, and to Grace, it's as though some child she never met did all those things. After Naomi says the blessing, the silence dissolves into a din. The table is crammed with people. Naomi, Rita and her huge husband Donnie, their three children, and Grace's unmarried cousin Clarence, who's tall and thin, all elbows. Rita and Clarence spent their teenage years as Grace's older brother and sister, more or less, because their father, her Uncle Vale, lost his hands in a hay baler, and their mother got to drinking whiskey. It's hard to imagine how they spent those years under one small roof. After concentrating on the long, quiet drive, Grace feels overwhelmed by the sudden commotion and plates of food to be passed. The boys seem right at home, though, talking with Donnie and Donnie Jr. about the Kentucky versus Louisville basketball game. At the same time, Rita is talking about how easily you could have a moment of carelessness you'd regret your whole life. On Donahue, she'd seen a woman who allowed her toddler to fall in the washer and drown. She turns her back 1 second for the fabric softener, and there he goes, in with the sheets, she says. No more static cling, cries Donnie Jr., who is old enough now to work at a gas station. Boo Boo Hardrick blowed his finger off with an M80, says Rita's daughter Karen. He pulled off the bandage at playtime and made me look. The way Rita's children talk shocks Grace. Maybe she has put herself above her family, as Naomi says. Karen, now hush. If you can't talk about something nice, Rita says. Is that Michael Hardrick or Bruce? The big one, Bruce. Was it blowed clean off, honey? He said clean down to the bone. Grace notices that Rita's hair is darker than last year. She started covering the gray. She and her brother look more alike as they get older, as angular as scarecrows. Grace's husband, Randall, is tall and thin too, but in a nicer way. He has long, slender hands and feet that she finds beautiful. I can't believe how grown up the kids are, she tells Rita. Donnie Jr. working? Our babies aren't babies anymore. They get growed up behind your back when you don't come home but every 7 or 8 years, says Naomi. Grandma, that isn't so. They come every year, cries Rita. Grace guesses from the way they all shout that Naomi has grown more hard of hearing. What's Randall up to? Donnie asks. Donnie, who seldom talks, has a voice that booms down in his throat like a bass drum. You could just talk with Donnie on the phone and know he was big. Same as always, Grace says, welding the front of a car to the back of a car about 100 times a day. Randall works at the automotive plant in Louisville. He likes his job. He wanted to come, Grace lies, but he couldn't get off. Anymore, that's about all anybody around here is doing too, said Clarence, working over to that Toyota plant the Japs put up down at Campbell. Doesn't seem like nobody can get a whole living out of farming anymore. That's the truth, Rita says. All the men have to go someplace else to work. There's nobody left in Clement now, of a daytime, but women and children. Somebody could just march in here and take the place, I guess. Going up to First Methodist with me tomorrow? Asks Naomi suddenly. Rita leans toward her and shouts, I told you, Grandma, me and Grace want to try out Woods Baptist. This is the first Grace has heard of it. Now, who's the pastor there? The old woman demands without looking up from her plate. She knows very well, Rita tells Grace. She's dying to go see for herself, only she's too proud. She shouts, You know very well, Grandma, it's the Beltrane boy. Oh, yes, Naomi says, reaching for a slice of bread. You remember Nestor Beltrane, Grace? He lived next door to us for a while there, next to your all's house on Polk Street. Grace can tell from the way the men are smiling at their plates that there's a joke hanging over the table, but she can't remember the Beltrane boy. If his getting the pastor's job was any big thing, Rita would have told her about it. Rita writes Grace regular letters in her curly, cursive hand. The news and calamities of Clement, all rendered benign by her fat O's and C's. She keeps in closer touch now with Grace's mother and father, who live in a trailer court in Tucson, Arizona, than Grace does herself. Sometimes Rita lords that over her, too, but Grace tries to be understanding. It would be hard to grow up in somebody else's house without a mother of your own. They're all looking at Grace. There is some secret here. Well, I can't place him, she says. I'm sorry. You couldn't have forgotten Nestor, said Rita. Nobody could forget Nestor. His daddy was Colonel Beltrane. Remember, that was on the school board and had his own parking place down at the courthouse? Nestor had asthma or something. He was a skinny little old boy with ears that stuck out of his head like tree funguses. The teacher used to grab them like handles. He was so bad. The men are practically laughing out loud. You men hush up, Rita says. It isn't that funny. Clarence says, You ought to remember him, Gracie. He'd like to have hung you. Rita interrupted him. David, stop making such a big show out of it and chew what's in your mouth, she says, and Grace is uncertain of what Clarence has just said. I can't stand this stuff, said David, Rita's youngest. It's stringy and it's got too much salt. Well, it's Kentucky cured ham, honey, and that's just how it tastes. You liked it fine last year. I remember the name, Grace says, Nestor Beltrane, but I can't picture him. Clarence, what did you say he did? Rita gives Clarence an odd warning look, but he answers anyway. I said, he liked to have hung you from a tree. Grace's hand rests on her throat. She looks at Jacob and Matt, who seem intent on their food. What do you mean, hung me? From that old mulberry tree out there, he said, pointing out the window as though it were still there. But this is a different house. I do remember the tree, Grace said. You was just little, Clarence says. He stood you up on a chair and put a rope around your neck and said to jump any time you was ready. You talking about that time he tried to string her up from the tree, asked Naomi. You two wasn't living here yet. I was the one that seen it. Grace, your mother and me was sitting in the kitchen doing up a mess of baked beans, and she looked out the window and of a sudden commenced to whooping and hollering. Naomi pauses for breath. She grabbed up one of her new Revereware pots and throwed it right at him, right out the back door. I never heard the likes of language coming out of her mouth. Apparently, this is the story Rita wanted to put a stop to, but now she laughs. She must have scared him good. I don't think he ever did come back into y'all's yard. Law, he used to come over pestering you an awful lot, Grace, and trying to get you to look at dirty magazines under the lilac bushes, said Naomi. Your mother would get mad, but not like that time. Well, he did so come back, Rita, said Clarence. Me and you and him used to Clarence, I think you better just shut up and clean your plate, Rita says. Used to what? Grace asks. She does know that Rita and Clarence were often put in charge of her for whole afternoons when her mother had to take in ironing. Sometimes Grace thinks Rita hasn't quite given up the job of being boss. You wasn't but about 3 or 4, says Naomi, when he tried to string you up. I don't expect you'd remember it. Grace doesn't, but she thinks she should. Or that it should have been talked about before now. Them magazines don't hurt nobody, Rita, so you can just get down off your high horse, said Clarence. Grace wishes she knew what they were talking about. She has a sudden, narrow recollection of something else. The smell of poultry feed. A cardboard box of ducklings in the corner of her classroom. Finding them dead. Nestor was not in her grade. He was older. But he had come into the room somehow and painted the ducklings with thick poster paints. They were dead by morning, their gaudy feathers sticking out like dry quills and their mouths gaping. She says, I remember who you mean. His daddy was the scout leader. Boot camp leader was what he was, says Donnie, helping himself to more ham. We all quit the scouts. Nestor was the only one put up with all that nonsense. He takes a bite and then says, I guess he didn't have much choice about it. Colonel had roused him out of bed and make him take a cold shower and go out barefooted in the snow. I think some of that was hearsay, Rita says, the bare feet in the snow. But he drove him hard, that's for sure. We seen it, didn't we, Clarence? Lord, they'd be out there on the sidewalk in their overcoats at the crack of dawn, doing jumping jacks and running around the block. We'd sit over by the front window pretending like we were looking for our galoshes or something so we could watch them out there before school. Hut-to, hut-to, barks Clarence in a forced imitation of the colonel, and he and Rita laugh. Rita smooths her hair back from her forehead with her palm. It was before this jogging craze hit. We'd never seen such a thing. They'd run around the block 8 or 9 times, and we'd hear Nestor wheezing out there, like he'd be breathing so hard. About to drop over dead, it sounded like. An old colonel right behind him, cracking the whip. Clarence screws up his face and imitates the colonel again. You will keep up with me, or you will die trying. Grace remembers a warm kitchen, cocoa and buttered toast, and looking through the house to the fogged front window, seeing through to the lean gray shapes of them out on the sidewalk. There were things that weren't told. Her mother stood near the window with crossed arms and a mouth pinched down at the corners by pity or anger. Mrs. Beltrain had a bone disease, people said. That was why her skin looked bruised and why she was always laid up in one or another combination of plaster casts. Just like that, they would say, applying a gentle pressure to your forearm. No more than that, and hers would have snapped like a straw. For weeks at a time, she wouldn't appear outside the house. The younger children are whining. Mom, Mom, can we have turkey next year? David wants to know. I hate ham. I do too, agrees Karen. It takes too long to chew. Turkey is for Thanksgiving, Rita says. For Easter, we have ham. If you don't like it, move to another house. Go live with your cousins. Grace feels uneasy. Matt, Rita told me Donnie Jr. has a computer game about dinosaurs. Why don't you all go take a look at it? The children look happy to leave the table. Now the colonel, says Naomi, that was a man made out of something. The colonel passed on. You know about that, Grace. I wrote to you about that. They said he cut up his whole steak one night and then put down his knife and died. Seemed like Mrs. Beltrain, the one whose bones broke if you just touched her, got a new lease on life. She put the house up for sale and moved to one of those army retirement homes, I forget where. It cut Nestor loose from his tether, though, says Clarence. He went and joined a commune. Clarence, I swear, Rita says, it wasn't a commune. It was that monk place down in Georgia. He was there, oh, I don't know, the longest time. And then the next thing we heard, he'd finished up at a Baptist seminary, and they'd hired him up at Woods Baptist. I don't think they took a good look at him first, Clarence says. He's got a beard and he speaks in tongues. It's true, Rita says. I think people are going up there for reasons other than to serve our Lord. It's a show, I'll tell you. He talks Hebrew or something. I went the other Sunday with Sue Carey, and we couldn't believe our ears. There's hardly nobody left of the congregation but the old folks, poor things. They just keep on turning up their hearing aids, thinking they'll understand him. I swear I think he's still got a mean streak. The table grows very quiet. From the other room, Grace hears the children's voices, quiet with concentration, and the steady beep of the video game. She has the odd sensation of watching this scene, her own family around the dinner table, from a great distance, like one of those people who've watched their own bodies on the operating table before coming back from death. The trouble with the boy, says Naomi, is that he got corrupted blood. They didn't boil it. I can't imagine what you mean, Rita shouts at Naomi in an encouraging way. When he was born, his mother liked to have died in labor, and the boy was born anemiated. They had to give him blood in the hospital, and you know very well where they get that blood from. She looks around at her subdued, grown grandchildren. Criminals, that's where. They sell their blood on the streets in Lexington and Louisville when they're on the down and out. They think they're getting away with something, but people here know about this. There is a long pause. What did you mean about boiling it? Rita asks. Boil it, said Naomi. That's what they do to get the criminal element out of it. But they got busy that day and they forgot. In her dream, Grace sees the elderly people of Clement sitting patiently on folding chairs under the mulberry tree. He ties nooses around their necks one at a time and explains in careful, smiling Hebrew that they're about to be murdered. She sits up with the memory clear in her head, more real than this strange bed in Rita's guest room. She must have been very young, too little to understand even the basics of gravity. He told her it would be fun. When she jumped off the chair, he said, she would swing to and fro in the breeze. She stood for a while, anticipating that pleasure, staring up into the wild mulberry canopy that shaded their yard and the Beltranes next door, watching while a breeze moved against the leaves. She can feel the knot against her jaw and his eyes on her, alive and quiet, as she prepares to end her life. The memory comes down on her like an ice storm, stiffening her to the center with cold rage. If her mother hadn't looked out the window, Grace thinks, or if she hadn't survived whatever it was that came later when Rita and Clarence were in charge, she would have spent these decades as a photograph, smiling its dead child's smile on her parents' mantelpiece, or just put away in a box somewhere. Even tragedies get forgotten. Grace puts her hands on the wall and finds her way to the room where the boys are sleeping. From the doorway, in the dim light, she can make out which sleeping bags on the floor hold Matthew and Jacob. Matt's has dinosaurs, and Jacob's has airplanes. They couldn't find one with endangered species. For a while, you saw pictures of whales and wolves and bald eagles everywhere you looked, even bumper stickers about the baby seals. But then, endangered species went out of style. Randall is right. Somebody knows when things start to get poisoned. What he says might be true, that you should get mad. She stands with her eyes on the heavy printed fabric until she finds the slow rhythm of their breathing. Her hands are trembling. She's never even known to count, like sheep or blessings, the days of her life that almost didn't happen. In the morning, Rita talks loudly while she and Naomi work around each other in the kitchen. It turns out it was cancer, she says, breaking eggs into the skillet, a cancer of the right ovary, as big as a mushroom. Sue said they just sewed her right back up again and told her to go on back home and get right with God. That poor woman, after all she's been through with Stanford. What about Stanford, Naomi asks, besides just the drinking? I know about that. Well, you know about the other two, him and that lady basketball coach from Campbell. She's not one half his age if she's a day. Grace is sitting at the coffee table with her third or fourth cup of coffee. The easiest thing, she thinks, is if this rage she feels could just be drowned like an orphaned cat. Grace, honey, if you don't stop drinking coffee, you're going to have to pee before your old buddy Nestor gets through the invocation, Rita says. He does it in Latin or something. Don't say I didn't warn you. Are the kids up? I'd swear they'd sleep right through church if we let them. Now, why is that? Remember when they were babies, they wouldn't sleep late on a weekend if you paid them $100. You better go rouse them out, says Naomi. Sunday school starts at 9. The boys and I aren't going, Grace says, without looking up. She can feel the change in the air of the kitchen. Not going to church on Easter Sunday, Naomi asks. I better go listen to the early weather and see if this storm's breaking up. I want to know what I'm in for, as long as we're driving back this morning. Rita is still staring at her, but Naomi has had the good manners to turn back around and tend to her sausages. Grace gets up, runs scalding water in her coffee cup, and plunks it down hard in the rack. Memories have been coming to her all morning. Nestor's and Clarence's magazines, for one thing. The ugliness that every one of them knew about. She knows there will be more to remember. She could forgive the act, she thinks, but not the attitude. Because an attitude doesn't ask and it doesn't end. The boys didn't bring the right clothes for church, she tells Rita and Naomi as she walks out of the room. The TV weatherman is jokey and annoying, not taking seriously the fact that bad weather can affect people's lives. He tucks his thumbs in the armpits of his tight gray suit and flaps his elbows, saying, "It's a nice day for ducks out there." But as they turn out onto the interstate, she can see for herself that the sky is lighter far to the west, toward Louisville, on the other side of the low thunderheads. Randall would just now be getting the Sunday paper, walking out barefoot on the sidewalk on dry ground. She braces herself for the road and drives for the light. So, how do you like that story?
Wonderful.
You like it? Good. Do you think it's preachy?
I don't.
When you start to realize that it's about these remembered childhood things, my sort of hair on the back of my neck goes up a little because you hear so much about it and you have all these false memories and real memories and stuff, but I think Kingsolver sort of does it pretty without sentimentalizing it or sort of overplaying it. What are the extinctions that she is referring to in the title, do you think? What is in danger of becoming extinct?
Besides the family, besides the whales and stuff, the family relationship is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same as it used to be.
Yeah, there's some danger there. There's extinction. I mean, she's forgotten that they eat at main meal at noon, and they say that she's forgotten the ways of the country, and that she's gotten on her high horse and she's gone to the city.
It's almost like she's doing things out of tradition and repetition rather than because she wants to. And a good family relationship, she would want to go back to the family to see them.
Yeah, she says she's dreading the trip there, and they always eat ham at Easter and Thanksgiving turkey Thanksgiving. But on the other hand, I mean, do you really think that, I mean, maybe the family is an endangered species here?
Maybe, says it ends, she headed for the light. Maybe the extinction is she has killed off this untruthful past that she was.
Mm-hmm.
She's ended it. She's heading for the light.
She's not going to put up with that anymore. But you don't have the sense that she'll never go back.
No, but does she want to?
Did you catch the two times that she lied?
Mm-hmm. She said the boys didn't bring the right clothes.
Uh-huh.
That one, the other one.
And the other
one didn't come.
Her husband couldn't come. Why did she lie those two times? Her husband couldn't come because he had to work, and the boy, we can't stay for church because the boys didn't bring the right clothes.
Socialize, not to hurt the other person.
Yeah.
Or to avoid conflict.
Avoid conflict and to maintain ties with that family, that part of her family. So she wasn't saying, I'm walking out of this family, never coming back. But she was headed back to her husband and her happier home with her own sons.
The extinction also could be to that she had extinguished these memories.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Now they're back. What did you think about her remembering them?
You almost knew something worse was going to come. When you said the hair stood up on the back of your neck, that is kind of what that woman's able to do when she writes, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So there's an interesting parallel between the when she sees herself almost as simply a photograph that would have been remembered, maybe put away in a closet, and when she talks about that's the way whales will be for the next generation. They won't be living beings, they'll be the photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And Rudy will be there around in that parallel.
Yeah. And then she came so close to being extinguished as a 3-year-old. And then her spirit probably came close to being extinguished by Nestor and Clarence, her cousin, and their dirty magazines and whatever all they did to her.
And that parallel that it's the attitudes towards those acts that are as poisonous or deadly as the acts themselves. And that sort of seems to be coming through at the very beginning when she's talking about, you know, the obliviousness to the world of the panda going extinct. The others is sort of the attitude, the callousness while we're doing Hondas and ATM machines.
Mm-hmm. Right. I love that line.
Wonderful.
And she said that she and her husband had never been able to agree at the beginning on the role of hope and anger, that he was always much more hopeful and therefore got more angry and said people should get angry about these things. And she was just sort of, it's hopeless.
But there was truth between them.
Yeah.
That she didn't experience with her family.
Yeah, and she was in dialogue with him, and they were...
Even if there was conflict or disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't she starting to tap into her anger, though, right at the end there? I mean, she's breaking through the denial part.
Yeah, she's definitely
out of it. So maybe there's the hope in that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my sense is that they are... She's moving toward her husband's position.
The extinction is of something that should be dead in this story, I think, don't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this thing with her mother being vigilant and catching and watching and protecting her from death, and her constant vigilance of watching over her sons.
Mm-hmm. I'm going in six times.
Is that a subconscious thing, or if that's a memory that, you know, because of late memories or...
Yeah, then right in the middle of this family dinner, they start talking about this Donahue show with the lack of vigilance.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman whose baby fell into the washer, and then they started telling stories of other disasters because of lack of vigilance. Somebody, kid who shot his hand off or something. And then her family and herself being vigilant and saving lives thereby.
Almost hyper-vigilant in response to or something.
Yeah. And then her son seems to have inherited that kind of intensity or focused vigilance because he's so into endangered species and wants people to pay attention to that and think about it.
So many things in this story. The son of the abusive father. I mean, we assume he was an abusive person.
The colonel was abusive.
And where he is, you know, but he's not, but he's alive.
Yeah, and so Nestor, who had asthma, I mean, he really could have died if you think about him being forced to run around all those blocks when he had exercise-induced asthma. Mm-hmm. You hear more and more about people dying of asthma now. But, so the father, and the father was obviously a brutal man, and some kind of a military set of images around him. And he beat up that wife, obviously, repeatedly. And then she was finally so relieved when he died. Kind of a mistake.
The feeling that the son also needed to find a way to be angry at what had happened instead of himself showing signs of becoming abusive in other ways than he had been as a child.
Right. He was a cruel child, a mean, spirited, cruel child, which is not surprising given the way he was being raised. And now, what about his role as a pastor, and what about the role of the church?
Very frightening. The abuse of power that's going
to
happen.
Does it resonate with our lives? I mean, does it make sense to you that someone who was a child who had been so twisted that would be drawn to the ministry in some kind of way?
The ultimate solution.
Say more.
Don't you think some of the David Koresh kind of person and the ones who become this great protective father of a cult sort of a group? Of course, he wasn't in a cult. He was a Baptist, wasn't he? But
the way he was doing it, he was, we've seen any number of times when someone would abuse their situation and in effect destroy their church, which he apparently was doing. Mm-hmm. Many people were just going away because they couldn't understand what was going on, and he just didn't care.
Yeah. I mean, I would say the ministry is probably one of a number of fields where someone like this, if he had enough charisma or talent, could play out an abusive mm-hmm. professional life. Right. And there is some small percentage of people in every profession, of course, who are inappropriate and abusive. But you can see why. If you were wanting power, and if you were sort of an asthmatic, weak, funny-looking person, and then you found you had some power of speaking in tongues or charisma or whatever, that you'd be drawn to a profession like that, and then you could be really cruel because you'd have so much authority somehow.
And you also have access to people's lives in vulnerable situations, and there's an automatic trust, and the assumed trust that's violated, and it's just, it's okay. Fair.
So you can be abusive while pretending to be protective.
It's fair game. It's,
like the little girl trusted him. She was going to swing. It was going to be fun.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think if you think of abused people, like, 80% of abusers have been abused, but you also think that it is sort of a way of, if the person really goes back and forth between trying to deal with it in some way, lots of times people will try to control the behavior and control it by sheer willpower. And religion becomes a very usual way to try to do that, to say, I will never do that again. And you constrain instead of getting help, you constrain your behavior by very rigid controls. Mm-hmm. So it may not even be going into it because somehow you looking for access, but because you think this is your salvation, getting involved again.
There are a lot of dimensions here, for most of us who are religious and want to be open about it, we become frightened when it becomes a certain kind of speaking in tongues, or at least I do. I guess I can't speak for anyone else, but when it gets to a point where it suddenly becomes frightening, and that's what I think we're afraid of, that it is a kind of a abusive cruelty, and it's when it gets to this point that it's firing everybody up. So are you following what I'm trying to?
I think so. It was said at Easter time.
dying. For dying with some look for hope, a search for hope, or something.
Death and resurrection. I mean, yeah, the extinction.
Yeah.
Going from the light at the end.
Well, I think it's a death and resurrection story.
Yeah. I was very interested because she can actually see the light she's driving to, but she also knows she has to go through those storm clouds. For, I mean, there's some questions about what she's moving towards.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and there's rain all the way through. There's references to the light and dark and to the weather. And at the beginning, the rain feels like bullets on the roof, and she feels apprehensive. And
thinking about the names of Grace and Naomi. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kind of why the author chose those names for those two characters.
Right. And
remarkable writer.
Yeah. I mean, Grace has to be named Grace for a reason if you're writing an Easter story.
There's a sense here just of near extinction. I mean, she was nearly extinguished. Mm-hmm. This boy who became a minister was on the edge of extinction, or could have been. And there's almost a sense of a refusal that's born within her, that she's refusing in her anger as she sees this scene being played out in her memory. And the unfairness of that, of, you know, not knowing, and now she's knowing. But that also liberates her to where she refuses. I think there's a sense of resolve or a sense of refusal that she, at least what she has with Randall and her kids, is not going to be on the edge of extinction. She's going to go for survival, go for life, you know. And that she finally sees the difference as a result of that, just those hours.
Yeah. And she talks about the importance of truth in there.
Right.
You want to show all the truth, and the truth will set you free. There, you've done the starting of the next.
Do you suppose there's been references to this, to these incidents before that she doesn't remember or didn't trigger it in the same way? I mean, it's curious to me that, I mean, these people are snickering about all of this, and it's as if it's all brand new to her, but
yeah.
She's been having these kinds of events, I mean, going there for years, it sounds, that this is a traditional kind of pattern that they have.
What is it that says at the beginning of the story about, it kind of characterizes her family relationship, and I can't remember if it's that she's afraid of them, right, of their, I think at the very...
Her husband, Randall, says,
her husband thinks that the reason she's hesitant to go is because she's afraid of her family.
Afraid? Yeah, I thought that was
And he says she's addicted to sadness.
So maybe he's...
almost instinctively he sees something.
And about the resolve thing, it's interesting to think her first act of resolve is not to go to this church service.
Yeah.
What was the family going to get out of having her go to this church service when?
I remember she said
and she rejects it.
And Nestor was the pastor. That's the precipitating thing here, is that Nestor has come back to this town.
But it's interesting that, you know, you wonder what the family
is. It's almost sadistic.
Yeah, it's almost sadistic.
It is sadistic.
Yeah. And so she, for the first time, isn't going to participate. Let them. Yeah.
They've always gone to the Methodist church. All of a sudden, they have to go to this other church. And Naomi keeps asking, who is this guy? Why are we going there? What, you know, I mean, Naomi is questioning it and saying, I don't know about this. You know, you're going to come with me to the Methodist church? No, remember, Naomi, we're going to go to this here, Nestor. And Naomi won't go to Nestor. She's not going to go. So
it seems almost like it's Rita's idea.
It is Rita's idea.
Clarence doesn't seem to be involved in that part of it.
Yeah, it's definitely
Rita. She and says, Grace and I want to go.
Mm-hmm. Right, and Grace has never
Grace
heard...
Gonna,
right, but Grace knows nothing about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And Naomi is Naomi's not going to go. So it's like these, her husband, Donnie, and Clarence, and Rita are kind of in on this thing.
Yeah.
sort of tormenting her, really, mm-hmm. aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And probably always has.
No, you know if they had before, if it's just this nester mm-hmm. coming back into the setting, it kind of triggers the... they probably had suddenly been like talking about these things that happened when she was...
Yeah, she says she never remembers the things that they bring up.
Her whole childhood, she can't remember.
You can imagine this being a pattern that's repeated itself over and over, and that perhaps being one of the reasons Rambo refuses to go and watch his wife being treated this way randomly.
Yeah, tomorrow she and the boys have to drive 100 miles to have dinner and go to church with her relatives. It's Easter weekend, only once a year. She shouldn't resent it. Randall thinks Grace is afraid of her family, which of course is a mistaken opinion, but she does dread the trip. A storm has settled over all of central Kentucky, and she knows the drive will be hard. And then the scene before that is a scene of her not wanting to turn off the TV when they're doing the story about the pandas because she feels like it would be turning away from the truth. So she's trying to force herself to face the truth, even about the pandas. And the stuff about these lines about the pandas that are so poignant, paired up in zoos, they turn their backs on one another and refuse to participate in family life. It is as if the whole species is suffering from a terrible sadness, as though they'd looked around at what had happened and just given up. Grace doesn't blame them. She sits rigidly in bed next to her husband, arms folded tightly over her chest. You know, so there's some sense in which she's...
I was just going to say, I thought it was interesting they talked about family life, you know, when it sounds like it's more what they're saying, they turned away from sex, you know, when they say that the pandas turn their back to each other. I mean...
Procreation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't...
Didn't want the species to continue because there was no hope for the species.
But it was I guess the reason I brought that up is whether to her... there is a sense why family life was...
Because there's maybe some sex, some incest stuff in the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm wondering if to her there's...
And she may have to face the incest.
Lying.
There are even, you know, in relationships in a family, whether it's sexual or not, or incestuous or not, it can be sort of incestuous in a metaphorical way, mm-hmm. not necessarily in a literal way,
mm-hmm.
where people... cross boundaries and speak for each other without checking with them.
But that's attitude again. The attitude's there even though the act is not. Yes.
So to not participate in family life could be just to not participate in the intimacy that leaves you vulnerable to that kind of violation, whether it be sexual or otherwise.
And there's a way of knowing that without knowing. I mean, there's a way of her kind of intuitive part and the sadness that her husband recognizes. Is that's in the nature of secrets, is it's an erosion on the human spirit. That, and then you go back and you're in that same movie and it's just like, oh. You know, mm-hmm. you don't may not know what it is, but you know what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And until they tell her what the movie is, then she connects the events or the feeling that her husband had picked up on.
And on this first page, when she's saying, but it's the truth, says Grace. That's how things are with the ocean and the ozone and everything. Once they get around to looking, they find out that things are already way more messed up than anybody thought.
Right.
And then her husband says, that's not true. There's somebody someplace that knows when things start to get poisoned, but they try to keep it a secret. They know people would get mad. It's never too late to get mad, he persists, looking at Grace, needing for her to agree that there is hope. There has always been this difference between them, a deep gulf. She can't swim. She has a hard time getting mad and having hope. So it's really set up at the beginning beautifully.
Yeah.
It's just, Kingsolver is so good. She's really... wonder whether there are more things we need to talk about. I think this business of the whales becoming extinct like dinosaurs by the time her son's children are alive is the kind of major threat, you know, that this, all of these sorts of things will be, all the good, all the life-giving stuff will be in the past unless something changes, unless her husband's point of view can prevail.
Battling with despair.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I don't know if this relates at all, but I was mentioned, I heard Barbara Kingsolver on the radio once, and she was saying that one of the ethical issues that she confronts as a writer that's most challenging for her is how to get at these themes of deep pain and violence in a way that doesn't do further violence by having to be a vicarious kind of experience or enjoyment of them, but are also, you know, causing the flashback experience, those kinds of things. How do you use literature in a way responsibly to help flesh these out without irresponsibly misappropriating other people's experience or those kinds of things? It was very, very interesting to hear her talk about her own wrestling with ways to do that.
Hmm. Wow, that would be wonderful.
An essay on that too. That, well, she was sent some one of her the letters she received after one of her books were published.
After Bumblebees, right?
After Bumblebees, yeah. Was, why do you write about these horrible things? Isn't there enough violence in the world that you don't have to recreate it again? That, you know, why do we need this mirroring, endless mirroring of violence? And it's something she took quite seriously. And I think, in a sense, it's strange that someone should pick up that in her novel, because I think she does do it very responsibly anyway, but versus, say, you know, Tom Clancy or something.
Well, I think this, I think she often does this kind of, I mean, putting this at Easter with death and resurrection, I mean, I think she's very hopeful that she's life-giving. I don't see her as depressive and negative, hopeless endings of her works. I mean, here it's typical, the person, you know, she's driving toward the light at the end.
And also that she doesn't really tell you exactly what happened outside of it, as far as the beyond the...
She doesn't go into the gory details.
No, yeah, and I which may be what...
That's why she's so effective. She doesn't spell everything out. Mm-hmm. She leaves an all plot to imagination.
And she respectfully treats this main character and says she knows she's got a lot. This, she's probably going to have to remember a lot more, but she doesn't act like it all is done in 24 hours, and she doesn't trivialize what's happened. And I think she's good that way. I would like to have her write more in about religion. To use settings. I mean, for example, in the story I didn't do today, one of the things she says, there was a child who was miscarried. He was due at Easter, and he came at Thanksgiving. And he was born perfectly formed, but with flat little lungs, like wings, like butterfly wings. You know, it's such a powerful image. When she does use religious imagery, and any reference to religious stuff, I always find it quite interesting and riveting. So I hope she does more. She has a new book of short stories that I can't wait to get my hands on. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.